People are still bringing money. All right. Stop. No more money. All right. Last time I spoke to you about the question concerning what if Jesus had never been born? What would the world been like? Would it have made any difference? Yes, it would. As the thunder roars. That was God's answer. It's based on a book that I got from James Kennedy, now with the Lord, knows the truth, all the truth. Pastor up here, up the street a ways. And I picked up this book a number of years ago. And he goes through several different issues that talks about, well, if Jesus wasn't born, how would it affect this and this and so forth? The fact that some people think, hey, you know, better off if Jesus had never been born. Many people thought God was dead, proclaimed by the Time magazine back in the 60s. And we saw last time, Nietzsche said God was dead. Hitler said God was dead. A recent book by Richard Hawkins, a evolutionist British guy, head of the museums over there, in the book God's Delusion, God was dead. So all these other people, these great leaders, if you want to call them that, all thought God was dead. All the atheists tried to eradicate the idea of Jesus. But we know, as a couple of movies come out recently, the fact that God is not dead. He's well and doing just fine. We saw that there was one solitary life, Jesus, changed everything. Changed the history of the world. So that Christianity has brought more changes on the earth for the good than any other movement or force in history. Now, if you were all in seminary and so forth, this particular message would fall under the category of what we'd call apologetics. In other words, we're going to defend the faith. There's some people throughout the world today that say that Christianity is a negative influence on the world, and it has been for some time. Look at all the wars between the Catholics and the Protestants, and all the people that were killed because of religious goings-on, so forth. So we're going to defend and uplift all the positive things that Christianity has brought to the world. The first one we looked at last time was the Christianity's impact on the value of human life. We saw life is good. Life has value. In the old ancient world, life was cheap. There was child sacrifice, abortion, child abandonment, infanticide, euthanasia. Women were looked down upon. Christianity brought value to all life, from the womb to the tomb. We saw and we believe from the scriptures that life begins at conception. Therefore, life needs to be protected from the time of birth all the way to the time we die. That people have value. They don't lose value as we get older. Christians have brought many things to help people, the unborn. 3,000 pro-life pregnancy centers have propped up since 1973 to help women to make the right choice to keep their children. We hear a lot about it in the news. I'm in the news, you know, and we hear a lot about 50 people dead in Orlando. There's 43 dead in some other city. A plane crashes, 100 people die. 3,000 plus children are killed every day in this country. 1.1 million children are aborted. Christians are the only ones out there fighting to help change people's minds. Doesn't mean we go out and blow up abortion clinics. Right? We're not fighting fire with fire. In this case, we fight fire with assisting, helping women. Christians have also been involved in orphanages and establishing nursing homes. The concept of Christian brotherhood broke the fetters of slavery. It took some time, but we broke slavery in this country and in other parts of the world. Christianity has also brought eternal life and value to all life. The second thing we looked at was that Christianity's impact on helping the poor. Jesus encouraged generosity toward the poor and set an example of helping the poor. Christianity introduced that giving to the poor was an obligation of all people, each according to his own ability. You take your own personal funds and you help people. It's not like a lot of other politicians who go around stealing from Peter to give to Paul, or going around proclaiming that we really care about the poor by taking money from one group and giving to another while they themselves do nothing. Christians helping people with their own money. The other view, that's just stealing. redistribution of wealth. Right? We don't want to do that. The objects of the Christian's giving has always been orphans, widows, the sick, disabled, unemployed, in prison, those stricken with famine, war, and persecution. Christians have been involved in assisting and helping people. The third thing we looked at was that Christianity's impact on caring for the sick. In the Old Testament, taught principles of hygiene, bodily cleanliness, and nutrition and diet. If we applied those principles the Old Testament taught about, we could have cleaner, healthier, more productive lives. Jesus taught compassion for the sick by going and about healing the sick, lame, and the poor. Christianity played an important role in the development and institution of the hospital. The first hospitals were established for the care of the poor. The rich, in the old days, if you had money, the doctor would come to your house to take care of you. But the poor didn't have, so Christians got together and started a hospital to help the people, the poor people. Until the 19th century, hospitals were places that took care of the poor. You know, many of them have Christian-type names. Baptist Hospital in Miami. There's Presbyterian Church, Holy Cross, Catholic Church. You don't ever hear of St. Atheists, St. Agnostics. They don't care about the poor and the sick, right? No one's never named a hospital after an atheist, famous atheist. Christians, Joseph Lester and Louis Pasteur, were Christian men who, creationist, believed in six-day creation, and also were instrumental in developing certain types of sciences that helped bring about healthier people. Lester developed anesthetics and was the father of modern surgery. Louis Pasteur was the father of bacteriology, father of microbiology. They found out that, hey, viruses and stuff are germs. You know, and we got to help attack the germs or do things to help fight germs. So these were Christian men who brought healing. They could, all right? They brought healing to people. Florence Nightingale, Christian, devout Christian, who started, was the mother of modern nursing. Then we had Henry Durant, who was started the YMCA, Young Men's Christian Association, developing physical fitness and so forth, and also helped establish the Red Cross, helping victims of disasters and so forth. So we've seen that Christianity has been instrumental. Today, being the 4th of July weekend, we're going to now look at Christianity's impact on human government. First of all, where did government begin? The origins of human government. When did it begin? Well, it comes from God. We saw last time when Rev preached on Memorial Day from Romans 13, he says, "Let every soul be subject to governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and that the authorities exist appointed by God." And then verse 4, "If you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister," that is the person in the government, "is an avenger, an executor of wrath on him." Notice this, it's the sword. The sword was a specific Greek word that they used for executions. The government does not possess the authority to execute people for nothing. They have the right, the authority to kill and execute people who are committed capital crimes. Now, where and why did God establish human government? Well, if we go back to Genesis, back before the flood, in Genesis chapter 6 through 9, we find out when God established human government. Before the flood, there was no human government. What was the result of it? "Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every kind of intent of thought in his heart was only evil continually." The earth was also corrupt before God, and earth was filled with violence. So there was constant personal revenge and violence occurring at this time because there was no deterrent against murder and crime. So God brought the flood, destroyed everybody except for the 8 people on the ark. If you go throughout the world today and you look in the rocks, you see what? Dead things, fossils, everywhere. It's the evidence of a worldwide flood. It wasn't just some local little flood. worldwide flood. I went to, a couple years ago, back in 2007, went to Colorado, out in northwestern part, at Dinosaur National Park. And they were doing some renovating. The building that had been damaged during an earthquake, and you couldn't go to it. So we had to go up on a little trek and find a dinosaur bone on the side of a mountain somewhere. And they had a little paper brochure, and I opened it, I was reading it, and it said, all the dinosaurs in this park were killed in a gigantic flood. Really? Wow. They know. They all know that God destroyed the earth with a big flood. So, after the flood, God got Noah and his sons and his wives together also, and said to them in chapter 9, verse 1 through 6, he told them three things. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. That's a reiteration of what 2,000 years earlier, what he told Adam and Eve, to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth again. So they multiplied the earth. He also told them, the second thing, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. This is referring to allowing now men and people to eat animals. The moving things that lives shall be food. You know that in a technical sense, biblical sense, only animals, things that move, are living things. Trees and so forth are not actually living things. They're organic, but they're not living because they don't move around. Right? So before the flood, man was vegetarian. There was all sorts of plants and so forth for men to get the proper nutrition that they needed. After the flood, God now allowed man to then eat animals, as long as they didn't consume the blood that goes with it. Thirdly, this thing, the establishment of government. He says, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. For whoever sheds man's blood, by man's blood shall be shed. For the image of God, he made man. So now he's instituting a certain group of people to now have the authority to execute, bring judgment upon people who commit murder and other atrocious crimes as we may consider. And here we have the establishment of human government. Or Genesis 9, Romans 13, God established government as an institution to promote good and punish evil. It's a different institution than the church. The church does not have the authority to execute people, only the human government. Now, what kind of government is the right kind of government? That's a matter of opinion, right? What should we choose? Well, the traditional view, as we see oftentimes, is left and right. We have communism, socialism, social democracy on the left, and then we have what fascism, right-wing dictatorships, monarchies on the right, and somewhere in the middle we have democracies and republics. Now, I think a better way of understanding this, a view that I got from the John Birch Society, that came up with this kind of a scenario. Looking from left to right, we have a government that has 100% power and control over you. And then on the other side, we have anarchy, which is no government, zero control. Now, which of these types of government should we choose? First of all, monarchies, dictatorships are ruled by one. The American founding fathers, when they got the ground choosing their government, they thought, that's not such a good one. We just beat the British. We don't want to reestablish another one of those. On the right side is anarchy, which is ruled by nobody. Anarchies are temporary, and they're not very efficient. It creates chaos. Anarchy never really lasts for very long. Then there's oligarchy, which is ruled by a few. Really, in all monarchies and dictatorships or so forth, there's really not just one guy. There's one figurehead, but then he has his group. You know, Hitler had his brown coats, whatever. He had his Gestapo. He had other men that really controlled things, okay? It's just the same way in other countries. If there's maybe one figurehead, but then there's a small group of elite people that run everything. That's an oligarchy, so it's run by a few. Then there's a democracy. Hey, I like democracy, ruled by a majority. The founding father said, we don't want a democracy. The problem with a democracy is that it usually ends up with a mob rule. It's whatever the mob wants. whoever gets to the top and is able to convince the majority of people that a certain thing ought to happen, that happens. Doesn't necessarily mean whether it's right or wrong. They just want it, so they get it. So majority rule really is also something that's only temporary. So we see the monarchies and dictatorship existed, for the most part, up until the end of World War I. Then we see that there's oligarchy, which I would say that are communism, socialism, fascism. Those are all oligarchy-type governments. They're on the left, not on the right. Democracies are unstable and only temporary. Monarchies are also unstable and temporary. Then there's a republic, which we have, or we're trying to hold on to, and we have England and probably the majority of Western Europe. So we have power and control, the struggle between the people and those who rule over us, constantly in attempting to gain power. Now, our founding fathers, they had the rare opportunity to decide what kind of government they were going to have. After they defeated the British, they got together and decided what kind of government they wanted. They had the Articles of Confederation, something they had worked to put together during the Revolutionary War, but really wasn't something that was going to work. So they got together, as we all know, after they signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776, they got together again back in the 1780s to write the Constitution, to come up with what kind of government we were going to have. Now, Benjamin Franklin was asked, after he came out from signing this new constitution, a woman came up to ask him, says, "Mr. Benjamin Franklin, what did you give us?" And he responded, "A republic, if you can keep it," he said. They considered this an experiment, because this is something that never happened, a republic, in the history of the world. Now, the Romans had a very brief time where they had a loose republic, but it wasn't very good. It didn't last very long. The republic now has lasted now for over 200 years. So the republic, what kind of government is it? It's a constitutional government. It's also limited government. It's a government ruled by law. Now, our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, and then James Madison, who was the primary author of the Constitution, were both Christians. Well, Thomas Jefferson was a deist, okay? He didn't believe in the Trinity. He believed in the ethical teachings of Jesus and thought we should follow him. So he was a Christian in a loose sense. James Madison was an Anglican. They're a little off on some things we would consider, right? But they were Christians. People came from Christian culture and background. One thing they did understand is the wickedness of man. They understood. They had seen all of the conflicts that have occurred back in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries through Europe. The conflicts. And they decided, we can't trust men, so we're going to divide the government up. Divide the powers. And they based it on this verse from Isaiah 33:22. It says, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us." So you see the three branches of government that come out of this concept. The judge is the judicial. The lawgivers are the legislature. They're the ones who make the laws. And the king, or the president in this case, is the executive. He carries out and enforces the law. And then the judges decide whether or not the laws that were passed by the lawgivers match up with what the Constitution says, the ultimate law. So they saw that there needed to be a separation of powers, because they didn't believe that one man should have power. Because why? Power corrupts. You've heard this term. Power corrupts. Ultimate power corrupts ultimately. So if you get too much power to one person, you have ultimate corruption power. All right? They understood man is sinful. Now, under a constitution, a limited type government, the king is under the law. He cannot make law, despite whatever our current president is attempting to do. He's not supposed to make law. They kind of get around it by calling it other things, presidential verdicts and edicts and all this other stuff, mandates. But the president is not supposed to make law. Let me teach you a little Latin here. There was an old term, lex rex. Law, king. In a republic, the king is under the law. In an oligarchy, monarchy, socialism, communism, so forth, the king is above the law. He is above the law. He is the law. He decides what the law is. Now, limited government also emphasizes equal rights. This means that all men are created equal. Men and women, right? Black, male, female, black, white. We had to have a dispute and a war over to define what a man was. And also included, we decided, also included a people of darker skin color. And we continue to have debates today about when does life begin? When do they apply manhood? Obviously doesn't apply to a person, a baby in the womb. But the point was is that equal rights. The king was not greater than the people. The people aren't greater than the king. And the fact that the people is not less than the king. Everyone, king, people, are both equal under the law. And if the king or the president or whoever violates the law is supposed to be the rule over him. And he can be prosecuted for crimes under the law. Limited government also emphasizes that our rights are God-given. These rights were God-given, and the government could not infringe on those rights. They could not take them away. As Thomas Jefferson called them, inalienable rights. And he summarized them with life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness. Inalienable means undisputed. No question. These are all the rights that we all have. Now, there's a lot of talk these days about different types of rights. Gay rights, animal rights, all sorts of people promoting that they need rights. Now, all of those rights are, I would consider, not unalienable, undisputed. The right of abortion, that is not an undisputed right, because we constantly dispute about that. We're not in agreement with that. Gay rights. The same year that we voted, some people voted, to elect Obama to become president, in the state of Florida also had a referendum, which Obama agreed with at the time, stating that a marriage was between a man and a woman. That passed by over 80% in the state of Florida. The court declared that's unconstitutional. We can't have this. We can't have the people deciding what rights are. We decide what rights are. But those kind of things are not unalienable rights. That's a disputed right. Our rights originate from God and not from man. This is important because if God gives you the rights, they come from God, and then only God can take them away from you. No man, no government can take them away. But if there is no God, then where do rights come from? Well, it comes from the people who rule over you. They decide what your rights are. And they can take those rights away from you at any time, whenever they feel like it. Because they're not under the law. They're above the law. A republic. In a republic, the state serves the people. We the people, by the people, for the people. The government rules by the consent of the people. We give them consent to rule over us by representatives. In a oligarchy, the people serve the state. Now here's a question. Is America a Christian nation? That could be a matter of opinion, right? Is it a Christian nation? What kind of Christian nation allows slavery and abortion and all that? How can we be a Christian nation? Now, that's just a matter of opinion by some people. But there is a fact. There is a fact that America was founded by Christian people. That's undisputed. The Pilgrims, we all know about the Pilgrims. In 1620, landed on the Plymouth Rock, and they brought with them the Geneva Bible from John Calvin's city. Then later came the Puritans. They were all fleeing religious persecution, wanted to establish their own form of persecution of other Christians. But they were seeking to found a new country, as they call a city found on a hill that would be a beacon, the light for the rest of the world. The Mayflower Compact was a voluntary agreement by these pilgrims to govern themselves. They got together. They decided, we want to establish a new kind of community. And they did it by creating a compact, which is a forerunner of later what would become the Constitution. Came a pattern. A little side note here was, you know, the first year the pilgrims almost all died because they established a communal type of community the first year. And they were supposed to grow crops and then share it amongst themselves. And after the first year, they said they were about to die. And then the Indians came and helped them. But they decided, well, we're going to give each family or each group a plot of land, personal property, so that they would then grow their own crops. And they created abundance, so much abundance, they had a big feast called Thanksgiving. And they shared amongst each other from the things that they all grew themselves and then voluntarily then shared and sold to each other. That's how it became a prosperous community. Then there were numerous constitutions, governance, and compacts by the later settlers, paved the way for then the constitutional form of government. By the time we get to 1776, writing up a constitution was something that was rather common. It was something that the churches that had been doing all along. So it wasn't something that just came up out of the air. So a republic form of government already existed in many of the churches and served as the model for the American government. So America was founded by Christian people who sought to govern themselves. The birth of a republic form of government finds its origins in Christianity, and even, you could say, some, James Kennedy in his book, on Calvinism. Certain form of Calvinism, which emphasizes the total depravity of man. That man is sinful, and therefore he needs to separate the different powers of government. And they had a Presbyterian form of rulership in the church, ruled by elders, people who were then elected or voted into, had to have certain qualifications of moral and Christian character to qualify. If they did so, then they were then elected. So the idea of an election, voting people, and so forth, into a form of government was something that they were all familiar with. This type of government has to do with government by law, by elected representatives. Now, the first Great Awakening occurred in the 1730s and 40s, when George Whitefield from England came over and preached a bunch of sermons, and Jonathan Edwards, who was a Congregational Puritan pastor, lived in Connecticut, also preached a number, and a great awakening happened. A revival happened. And many people got saved during the 30s and 40s, who committed themselves to not just to believe in Jesus, but became disciples and grow the church. Many of our founding fathers were nearly all Christians. George Washington, you see that famous picture of him praying at Valley Forge. John Witherspoon, the only minister who signed the Declaration of Independence. I mentioned that because my grandmother's family's from the Witherspoons in North Carolina. I don't know if we're related or not, distant related. There, he was in New Jersey, the founder of Princeton University. 50 of the 55 signers of the Declaration of Independence were considered to be Christian, at least in the small capital C sense. So the overwhelming majority of the creators of the Constitution were practicing Christians who derived their political philosophy from the Bible and other Christian sources. So Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, now they didn't come up with these ideas all by themselves. They had gone to universities. James Madison, I believe, was Princeton. Thomas Jefferson went to William & Mary there in Williamsburg. And they studied. They studied these other two guys who lived about 100 years before them by the name of John Locke and Thomas Reed, who was the father of Scottish common sense, as they called it. They came up with some of the enlightened ideas where that we would not consider them Christian like we're Christians, okay? But they weren't atheists and so forth. They believed in God and so forth. And they were philosophical and political theorists. But because of the situation in England and the days that they lived, they weren't going to do anything about trying to change the status quo of a monarchy in England. So it wasn't until Thomas Jefferson and the others that took their ideas, along with the biblical ideas, and created an American form of government. So, is America a Christian nation? Was it founded by Christians? Yes. Was it solely Christian? Probably not. When you look at the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, where it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident. That could be true for an enlightened person. It's self-evident. It's common sense, right? But we'd also say that that would also be true. We would say, we hold these truths to be revealed from Scripture. We could also say that. Some of the ideas and concepts of the type of form of government that they founded, continue to have, was a Christian form of government. So, here's another opinionated question. Is America a great nation? Depends on where you go. Some people say, America's the greatest nation that ever existed, right? If you go to Europe or some other countries, they say, no way. You even got people in our government today who say, America's never been a great nation, or maybe it's become a great nation now. Like Michelle Obama said that she was not proud of her country until her husband was nominated for become president. It wasn't a great nation. Now it became a great nation because I'm proud of it. We have people today who don't think that America, as founded, was a great nation. Of course, we have a candidate going around, we want to make America great again, right? Because there's some people who don't think that it never was a great nation. Some people, well, why is he saying it's great again? It's great now. Is America a great nation? Well, matter of opinion. The fact is, the Christian faith played a vital role in the development of the United States of America and has given the world a great model of government. That is an undisputed fact. So Christianity has made an impact on the world. If Jesus had never been born, much of this would never have occurred. So be appreciative of your country. Thank God for the founding fathers. If you think this is a type of government we should have, vote. Go out and vote. You know, 50% of Christians don't vote for whatever reason. Go out and vote and be a voice. Again, think about these things as we celebrate, as the fireworks go off tomorrow, about our great nation, and thank God for it.